Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. Hotspots and hybrid learning. Mason City schools provide free internet. When the Mason City Community School District announced it was conducting a hybrid return to school this fall, leaders in the district knew that internet access would be a necessity for all families in the community. In August, the district said it would run a four-day school week with 2 days in person and 2 days online. Because of this, much of the classwork would be done online, and the school district needed to make sure that all students had access to it. How could students who didn't have Wi-Fi at home access their classwork? Hotspots. The district used funds from the Elementary and Secondary School Emergency Relief Fund to provide up to 300 hotspots for families in the community. According to Executive Director of Curriculum and Instruction, Susan Pekanowski, the district has issued 295 of the 300 available hotspots. Around 20 have been used in the schools, and 275 have been given out to families in the district. It's been excellent because what it does is it allows children to access their content for learning when they're not in a face-to-face learning environment, Pekanowski said. The district sent out a technology survey during the spring in conjunction with the Iowa Department of Education to assess the levels of access that families had to Wi-Fi. And from that, it confirmed what we knew, which was that in some cases, we had families that did not have internet access, Pekanowski said. If we were going to be able to provide an equitable education for children, then we had to think about how we would provide opportunities for internet access. The idea for hotspots came out of those conversations. The U.S. cellular hotspots have been distributed by the district and are easy and simple to set up. There's no need for professionals to visit homes and install them, as it's just a small device. Superintendent Dave Versteeg shared at the September 7th Board of Education meeting that the company feedback has been positive and the project is going well. We've been able to help people out as they're doing the continuous learning and teaching the class online, Versteeg said. That's the worst thing that can happen is have no internet. So that's going really well, and we can get more if we need to. Annalisa Miner, a community member, is thankful that the district is doing this for students and families who need it. She helped her neighbors go through the school district and get set up with one. This family is so appreciative of the school doing this, Miner said. They have a freshman daughter who is just overjoyed that she had the internet because she's never had it at home. She's had to go other places to try to get online, and they're just so appreciative and so thankful that the school is helping them. In order to continue to keep the hotspots up and running, there will be more expenses. Pekanowski says additional federal technology funds will be used to support the ongoing monthly costs associated with giving students network access. It's our plan that families will continue to have access to these hotspots, Pekanowski said. It isn't a situation that we're going to provide the hotspots and then not have the students be able to access it. The district is now a few weeks into the hybrid start to school. Pekanowski says there have been some ups and downs in the online part of learning and that the goal is to always think about the future and plan for on-site learning. We also believe this is an opportunity, Pekanowski said. What can we learn from this that we'll want to continue to provide to our students, regardless of the structure moving forward? Even in the hybrid learning model, many families in Mason City can successfully stay educated with the help of these hotspots. Iowa posts 14 new virus deaths, third fastest spread in U.S. Iowa on Thursday reported more than 900 new confirmed coronavirus cases and 14 deaths in the past 24 hours, as a federal report said the state has one of the nation's highest infection rates. As of Thursday morning, Iowa Department of Public Health data showed 918 new confirmed cases in the past 24 hours, raising the state total to 76,965 known positive cases. An additional 14 people died, for a total of 1,248 deaths attributed to COVID-19 since March. The data also shows an increasing number of children under age 17 have tested positive for the virus, with the total now 5,929. That's an increase of 389 cases since Monday. More than 2,700 educators have tested positive for the virus. In a report released Sunday, the White House Coronavirus Task Force continued to place Iowa in the red zone for cases. Iowa has the nation's third highest rate for new cases per 100,000 people. The task force noted Iowa has seen a decrease in new cases in the past week. The report repeated a recommendation that Iowa implement a statewide mask mandate. Governor Kim Reynolds insists a mandate wouldn't be effective and isn't needed. Cerro Gordo COVID-19 data snapshot for Wednesday, September 16th. 76,050 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Iowa. 965 total lab-confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Cerro Gordo. 678 total recovered in Cerro Gordo. 287 total active cases in Cerro Gordo. 1,234 deaths in Iowa. 21 deaths in Cerro Gordo. 17,312 COVID-19 tests administered at the mobile testing units. A status report of monitoring and testing of COVID-19 in Iowa, including county-level data provided by the Iowa Department of Public Health, can be found at coronavirus.iowa.gov. Iowa governor won't budge on masks, even as virus deaths rise. Plenty of Republican governors initially rejected mask mandates, but few have held to their skepticism amid soaring coronavirus cases with the tenacity of Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds. Reynolds scoffs at calls for a statewide mask order, calling them feel-good actions, and refuses to let city officials enforce local mandates, even as the small, largely rural state maintains one of the highest COVID-19 positivity rates and has topped 1,200 dead. While she implores residents to wear masks while indoors when social distancing isn't possible, she has said not everyone believes they're effective and frequently is photographed mingling at crowded events without a mask. "I think the goal is to do what we can to reduce the spread of the virus," Reynolds said last week. "I believe that is the end goal and that we can get there without a mask mandate. I believe that, and that's what I'm going to consistently do." It's a stand that has frustrated public health experts and exasperated some mayors. But unlike governors in other states, Reynolds has made clear she's not budging. Reynolds' argument against a mandate boils down to 3 points. A mask requirement can't be enforced. Other factors are to blame for rising virus cases. And people should have the freedom to make their own choices. "I trust Iowans to do the right thing, and I think they are doing the right thing," she said. Faced with rising virus cases, other Republican governors took a decidedly different approach. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott had for months said the state couldn't order people to wear masks. But in July, after virus cases and hospitalizations soared, he ordered that face coverings be worn in public throughout most of the state. It was a similar story in Mississippi, where Governor Tate Reeves resisted a mandate before issuing an executive order requiring masks at public gatherings and in retail stores during August. He later extended the order through September 14th. Georgia Governor Brian Kemp also reversed course last month when he signed an executive order allowing local mask ordinances to be enforced on public property and on private property if the owner agrees. The governors of North Dakota and South Dakota also have rejected mask mandates, but their stands are now being tested as coronavirus cases increase in both states. In Iowa, calls to require masks have increased and now include the White House Coronavirus Task Force. The group late last month noted Iowa had the highest rate of new cases in the nation per 100,000 people and found more than a quarter of Iowa's 99 counties had high levels of transmission. Those rates have since dropped slightly. The task force called for a statewide mask mandate, closure of bars across the state, restricted restaurant attendance, and limits on crowds to no more than 10 people in the worst 28 counties. Reynolds closed bars in 6 counties, but ignored the mask recommendation along with most of the other guidance. Chantel Sloan, an associate professor at Brigham Young University, who specializes in infectious disease epidemiology, said the problem with not imposing a mandate is that only 15-20% noncompliance in a population is enough to cause significant preventable outbreaks. States with mask mandates and careful testing and contact tracing to isolate those with the virus could see significant improvement in spread in 3 to 4 weeks, she said. I continually believe that we have this ability to unify if we choose, and that this is completely up to us as a society, she said. It's just a matter of compassion. Photos of Reynolds at events without a mask frequently circulate on social media. Although Reynolds said it's often a case of her removing her mask only for a quick photo, some pictures show her with no mask while mingling with people, hugging individuals, and holding conversations well within 6 feet of others. We'll take them off for not even a minute, snap a shot, and then we'll put them back on, Reynolds said. I try to lead by example, but remember, if you can, social distance. But if you can't, you should have one ready and you should put it on. Often in the photos, Reynolds is at Republican events where few people are wearing masks. A survey released September 10th by the nonprofit Kaiser Family Foundation found that while 80% of respondents said wearing a mask helps to limit the spread of coronavirus, more than a third of Republicans said wearing a mask is harmful. That compared to 7% of Democrats and 17% of independents who said masks could be harmful. The survey found that 32% of Republicans said masks do not help limit the spread of the coronavirus, while just 3% of Democrats and 17% of independents had that belief. The survey of 1,199 adults had a statistical margin of error plus or minus 3 percentage points for the full sample, 7 percentage points for the Republican sample, and 6 points for the Democratic and independent samples. Despite such doubts, health experts say mask effectiveness is no longer a question. More than 300 Iowa doctors and other medical professionals sent Reynolds a letter in July pleading for a mask mandate and held a demonstration on the steps of the Iowa Capitol to emphasize the need for a mask requirement. The CDC also recommends masks, saying they are most likely to reduce the spread of COVID-19 when they are widely used by people in public settings. Officials in Des Moines and Cedar Rapids, the state's largest cities, have instituted mask requirements along with at least 8 other cities, even though Reynolds insisted the rules couldn't be enforced because she hasn't issued a statewide order. Des Moines Mayor Frank County said he believes the mask requirement he enacted on August 26th helped lead to a drop in the city's 14-day positivity rate from 20% to around 12%. It isn't about politics to me, it's about science, he said. Taking a political position on it, I think, is wrong. My obligation as mayor, to me, is number one, protecting the health and well-being of our citizens. As bars reopen in 4 counties, Iowa governor says state now will seek out bad actors. Governor Kim Reynolds signaled Wednesday her administration will take a more targeted enforcement approach in dealing with bad actor businesses that violate COVID-19 restrictions, rather than taking a countywide shotgun action to shut down bars, taverns, and other establishments. I'm trying to thread that needle, Reynolds told reporters in defending her August 27th decision to temporarily close bars or restrict the sale of alcohol in 6 counties where the number of COVID-19 cases had spiked. I'm trying to protect the health and safety of Iowans. I'm trying to protect the livelihoods of Iowans, the governor noted. She said the closures became necessary when stronger enforcement efforts weren't achieving the hoped-for goal of slowing the COVID-19 spread. On Tuesday, Reynolds issued a revised emergency order that keeps bars around the University of Iowa in Iowa City and Iowa State University in Ames closed until at least Sunday, but allowed those around Cedar Rapids, Cedar Falls, and Des Moines to reopen at 5 p.m. Wednesday. The governor's new proclamation continuing the public health disaster emergency permitted bars, taverns, wineries, breweries, distilleries, nightclubs, country clubs, or other social or fraternal clubs, including wedding reception venues, to reopen in Blackhawk, Dallas, Linn, and Polk counties. It also removed restrictions on hours that alcohol may be sold in restaurants in those 4 counties and clarified the social distancing requirements that still apply to all bars and restaurants in the state. Reynolds said she hopes the closures in the 6 counties got people's attention regarding the seriousness of the pandemic and the need to follow safety guidelines. Now that we've seen the trends come down, she said, they know that we're serious about enforcement and following the guidelines of the emergency health declaration. We'll continue to monitor the counties. But in addition to that, we've streamlined the enforcement process, she said. Due process, she said, had been taking several weeks. It will now happen in a week's time, she said. We can go in, we can continue to do education, we can give them a little warning, and if they don't do what they're supposed to do, then we will take the next step, which is to fine and to shut them down. My goal, since we can do that in a more timely manner, we need to push the bad actors and not the ones that are doing it right, she added. I didn't have the luxury of doing that with the spike in cases that we've seen. Since then, we've refined the process. We believe we can now do that moving forward. Reynolds said the enforcement approach is intended to strike a balance between compliance and consequences. We'll work with the businesses so they know what the rules are, they know what the expectations are, and then they can make a decision, and if they decide not to be part of the solution, there are consequences, the governor said. House Democrats concerned Iowa won't meet COVID-19 testing requirements for long-term care. House Democrats expressed concern that Iowa's COVID-19 testing program at long-term care facilities set out by the Governor Kim Reynolds administration will not be able to meet the requirements spelled out under revised federal guidelines to prevent outbreaks among staff and residents. Legislative Democrats made public a letter from the State Department of Public Health and State Hygienic Laboratory to long-term care partners in Iowa, indicating state facilities likely could not provide testing services for surveillance purposes until the Federal Health and Human Services Agency supplies rapid point-of-care diagnostic testing supplies and equipment to Iowa facilities. State health officials say they have partnered with long-term care centers in COVID-19 testing and will continue to do so. But they noted that the volume and frequency generated by the new federal requirement for routine staff testing on top of current testing will exceed the state hygienic lab's capacity. Therefore, the state hygienic lab will be unable to provide and process routine tests for Iowa's long-term care facility staff members for the purpose of complying with the federal rule, the letter said. If facilities are unable to meet the new federal testing requirements due to lab availability, supply shortages, or other reasons until the promised supplies and equipment arrive, state officials said in the letter, they are instructed to document their attempts to perform and/or obtain testing in accordance with the guidelines. This letter is intended to serve as documentation that neither the State Hygienic Lab, the Iowa Department of Public Health, nor county public health departments in Iowa can provide testing services for surveillance purposes as outlined under the new federal provision. The State Hygienic Lab will continue to provide testing support for symptomatic staff and residents, close contacts of cases, and when working with public health and long-term care facilities if positive cases are identified, the letter said. In a news release, Representative Timmy Brown Powers, a Democrat from Waterloo, expressed concern that Reynolds administration officials were informing long-term care facilities they are unable to provide routine testing to prevent outbreaks at the centers at a time when Iowa has 39 such outbreaks with 925 positive cases and 657 of Iowa's 1,248 COVID-19 deaths have occurred at long-term care facilities. More Iowans will die as a result of this terrible decision, Brown Powers said. Instead of expanding testing to prevent outbreaks and keep Iowans safe, Governor Reynolds is moving us backward and starting to ration COVID tests used to protect our most vulnerable in nursing homes and those on the front lines. More than 6 months into this pandemic, we should be testing thousands more, not less, Brown Powers added. Iowa is already a world hotspot for COVID, and this change will make it worse. This is a complete failure by the Reynolds and Trump administrations to prevent outbreaks and stop the spread of COVID. However, Reynolds spokesman Pat Garrett said the information in the House Democrats' news release is not accurate, and there will be no decrease in testing. The state of Iowa has and will continue to be a leader of testing at our long-term care facilities. IDPH and SHL continue to test in facilities when staff or residents become symptomatic and when positive cases are identified, Garrett said. New federal guidelines requiring routine testing of staff could generate more than 130,000 tests per week, in addition to the significant testing that's already underway, he said. The increase will exceed SHL's capacity and is why the state will need to rely on incoming federal support. As the letter noted, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services intends to supply rapid point-of-care diagnostic testing supplies and equipment to long-term care facilities in Iowa. Mason City Chamber Cup event sets stage for team-building, friendly competition. The Mason City Chamber of Commerce hosted its inaugural Chamber Cup event in Central Park on Thursday. 8 teams of 4 from area businesses and organizations competed for bragging rights in a series of relays and physical challenges. The Globe Gazette, Chris's Kettlecorn, Berglund & Cram, First Citizens Bank, North Iowa Corridor Economic Development Corp., ServPro, 98.7 Kiss Country, and Memorial Park Cemetery participated in the games, which included jump roping, power walking, chair racing, a paper airplane race, and a cheer competition. Chris's Kettlecorn took home the first place trophy, and the Globe Gazette's Jared McNett walked away with the award for best hair. Organizers say they are considering making the Chamber Cup a recurring event. Clear Lake Group plans to build inclusive playground in 2021. The Everybody Plays Committee will break ground on an inclusive playground in Clear Lake in 2021. That's what it announced on social media earlier this month. Since we had to cancel our fundraisers for the year, we ultimately had to move our groundbreaking back as well, the committee wrote on Facebook on September 8th. However, we feel the wait was worth it as now we're closer than ever to our original goal and will be able to build our playground all at once rather than in phases. Everybody Plays is a community initiative to build an inclusive playground in Clear Lake that would provide children and adults of all ages and abilities the opportunity to play together. There have been discussions about building the playground on 12th Avenue South within the city's 30-acre outlet recreation complex or on South 15th Street near the city's Aquatic Center. It was the committee's goal to begin construction on the inclusive playground this summer, but because of fundraising and the COVID-19 pandemic, it decided to delay it until 2021. The committee has been fundraising for the project, estimated to cost at least $275,000 for more than 2 years. Christina and Grant Molesby of Clear Lake, who are the parents of 2 children with autism, came up with the idea for the Everybody Plays Inclusive Playground more than 3 years ago while visiting Ankeny's Inclusive Playground with their children. They launched the project's fundraising with the Everybody Wins When Everybody Plays event, including entertainment, food, and silent and live auction in May 2018. Since then, the Everybody Plays Committee has hosted multiple fundraisers as well as received private and business donations and grants. In March, the committee was forced to postpone its adult prom fundraiser due to the coronavirus. An anonymous donor jump-started its fundraising efforts in July by giving $100,000 toward the project, including groundwork, specialized playground equipment, and surfacing and project management. We are so excited to bring this playground to Clear Lake. We are proud to say our fundraising initiatives are super close to completion, the committee wrote. In addition to the $100,000 anonymous gift, the committee has received $50,000 from the Hansen Foundation, $14,500 from the Clear Lake and Mason City Rotaries, $5,000 from McKesson Corporation, $5,500 from the Iowa Knights of Columbus, $5,000 from the First Citizens Charitable Foundation, $5,500 from Bicycle Blues and Barbecue Festival, $1,000 from Alliant Energy, $1,767 from Clear Lake Fairway, amongst funds from private donations, grants, and fundraisers. Additional funds will go toward expanding the project with more specialized equipment. Thank you so much to everyone who has donated so far, the committee wrote on its Facebook page. We can't wait to see all the kids playing together on our Everybody Plays playground. The Everybody Plays committee will be looking for community volunteers in the spring to help assemble the playground, and it hopes to have it done by summer. Those interested in donating to the Inclusive Playground Project are encouraged to do so by visiting Clear Lake Bank and Trust or messaging the Everybody Plays Facebook page. Algona shuts down volleyball for 2 weeks after positive COVID-19 test. The Algona varsity volleyball team has been shut down for 2 weeks due to a positive COVID-19 case within the program. In a letter to parents, students, and staff, Algona Superintendent Joe Carter said that Kossuth County Public Health determined that several varsity volleyball players had been in close contact, but it was not during practice, busing, or competition. Because of this, all varsity volleyball activities are on hold until September 29th. While I'm sure you share our disappointment with not being able to compete at the varsity level for this short time, we are grateful that we are able to have our season during this unprecedented time, Carter's letter read in part. We are very proud of our students and coaches and the manner in which they represent Algona Community Schools. We have and will continue to work within the parameters set forth by the CDC, IDPH, IGHSAU, and local health officials to facilitate safe practices and activities. Our coaches and staff have worked diligently to minimize COVID-19 exposure in several ways, including sanitizing equipment, using social distancing measures when possible, and the use of hand sanitizers. Despite these efforts to minimize any exposure, we know that COVID-19 exists within our community. Pending decisions from opposing programs, all other Algona volleyball events will be played as scheduled. Algona is currently 5-11 on the season. The Bulldogs will miss a total of 3 games due to the shutdown. Their first scheduled game after returning will be October 8th at Humboldt. Iowa Supreme Court lets rulings on absentee requests stand. The Iowa Supreme Court is refusing to review lower court decisions that invalidated tens of thousands of voters' absentee ballot requests at the urging of President Trump's re-election campaign. The court issued orders Wednesday denying requests to put rulings in Linn and Woodbury counties on hold. The elections commissioners in those counties, an affected voter and Democratic-aligned groups, had asked the court to intervene, saying thousands of voters could be inconvenienced and potentially disenfranchised if the rulings stand. The court rejected all of their requests without explanation. The county sent absentee ballot requests to registered voters filled with their personal information, including names, addresses, dates of birth, and voting PIN numbers. Voters had to review, sign, and return the forms to request absentee ballots, which will be mailed beginning October 5th. The Trump campaign and Republican Party groups sued, contending the pre-filled forms violated a directive from Secretary of State Paul Pate that they must be blank when mailed to voters. Judges Ian Thornhill and Patrick Tott ruled in Trump's favor, ordering the counties in Johnson County not to process any of the pre-filled absentee ballot requests. About 80,000 voters in the 3 counties had already returned such forms. Now they'll have to either fill out new blank absentee ballot requests or vote on Election Day. Ernst campaign charges Greenfield caught red-handed violating fundraising rules. A core message of U.S. Senate Democratic challenger Teresa Greenfield has been that Republican incumbent Senator Joni Ernst can't be trusted. Joni Ernst was caught knowingly accepting illegal contributions from corporations and had to pay the largest penalty ever for an Iowa politician, according to a Greenfield campaign ad. Ernst's campaign was even caught red-handed taking illegal contributions from corporations. However, in a September 15th letter, the Federal Election Commission has flagged Greenfield's campaign, saying its fundraising report discloses one or more contributions that appear to exceed the limits of $2,800 per person to a campaign. Her campaign has 30 days to reply to the FEC, but the Ernst campaign isn't waiting for a ruling. In the words of Teresa Greenfield, Ms. Greenfield has been hypocritically caught red-handed taking illegal contributions, said Ernst campaign spokeswoman Melissa Dietsch. The situation is part of a pattern for Greenfield, Dietsch said. Coupled with her campaign getting caught with election fraud for submitting false signatures in exchange for ballot access, it's clear Teresa Greenfield can't be trusted, she said. In 2018, when Greenfield ran for a U.S. House seat, her campaign manager was charged with a felony election fraud. The FEC letter asked Greenfield's campaign to further explain 18 donations totaling $81,000, a $30,600 discrepancy. The Greenfield campaign downplayed the letter, saying it was not the same as Ernst's violation in 2017, when the FEC penalized Joni for Iowa for receiving $37,190 in excessive contributions. The Ernst campaign fired the fundraising firm involved and paid a $14,500 fine because the funds were not returned within the permissible time frame. Notices like these asking to review how contributions are attributed are routine, Greenfield spokesman Sam Newton said. It is Senator Ernst who was forced to pay the largest FEC fine in history for an Iowa politician after knowingly and illegally accepting prohibited contributions from corporations. She also still refuses to explain reports she illegally coordinated with a dark money group set up by her own top aides. You are listening to the reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, September 17th, 2020, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Jerome Jerry E. Hemrich, 1934 to 2020. Jerome Jerry E. Hemrich, age 85, of Fairfield, passed away September 11th at the VA Medical Center in Iowa City. A celebration of life service and interment in New Haven will be at a later date. In lieu of flowers, a memorial has been established and can be mailed to Karen Hemrich, 208 South Court, number 213, Fairfield, Iowa, 52556. Online condolences may be made to the family at behnerfh.com. Charles Hackenmiller. Celebration of life for Charles Hackenmiller will be held Saturday, September 19th from 2 p.m. until whenever we tire of celebrating. Location is 4499 Rampart Avenue in Stacyville, the farm. Please help us celebrate a life well lived. Contact Shirley Hackenmiller at 507-438-9856 with questions or concerns. Norman L. Subi, 1927 to 2020. Norman Luverne Subi, 93, of Osage, formerly of Clear Lake, died Monday, September 14th at Faith Lutheran Home in Osage. Per Norman's wishes, his body has been cremated and no services are scheduled at this time. Interment will be at Brushy Point Cemetery at a later date. Norman was born February 12, 1927, the son of Elbin and Beulah Hovland Subi in rural Fertile. He grew up and attended school in Fertile. He enlisted in the United States Coast Guard and served during World War II. Norman was a truck driver for Montgomery Ward and Company for over 35 years. Norman is survived by his two sisters, Elsie Chisholm and spouse Leo of Osage, and Sandra Oswald of Johnston, and many nieces, nephews, and cousins. He was preceded in death by his parents and three brothers, Arden, Adel, and Ronald. Mitchell P. Hildman, 1973 to 2020. Mitchell Paul Hildman passed away unexpectedly on September 11th. Mitch was born on September 19th, 1973, to Glenda Hansen and Charles Denny Hildman. He is survived by his husband, Matt McKenzie of St. Paul, Minnesota, daughter, Hattis Negi, and spouse, Angit, brothers, Phil and spouse, Tanya, and Tony and spouse, Jean, sisters, Sarah and Jessica, and spouse, Diane, nieces, Carrie, Justice, and Sarah, and nephews, Walker, Cody, and Noah. A family service will be held on Saturday, September 19th, at the Cremation Society of Minnesota, St. Paul location. In lieu of flowers, please make a donation in Mitchell's name to Second Harvest Heartland. Abby and the Absolutes returns to Mason City stage this weekend. A popular musical review is returning to Stebbins Children's Theater in Mason City. Abby and the Absolutes will take the stage four times this weekend at the theater, 616 North Delaware Avenue, with shows at 6 p.m. and 8 p.m. Saturday and 2 p.m. and 4 p.m. Sunday. This is entertaining. Come in and watch our show, said McKenna Hansen, who plays Connie. You can't do a lot of other things right now, but you can come see our show. The musical review, written by Stebbins Executive Director Tom Ballmer, is a tribute to all the adorable girl groups and love songs of the 1960s. Abby and the Absolutes, which is the first show of the 2020-2021 season, follows the journey of a girl group from its early beginnings in middle school to the big time, including new management and relationship drama. The show was brought to life by a 6-person cast, including Jenyea Everest, who plays Mavis, Ava Civarelli as Darlene, Grant Bowles as Uncle Sam, and Jack Siglin as Chuck. Hansen's character, Connie, and her relationship woes inspire much of the group's music. She's described as emotional, flirtatious, and a little bit ditzy. She kind of loves everyone, especially all the men, Hansen said. Because she gets into so many problems with her emotions, she's really great inspiration for Mavis to write songs about. Abby and the Absolutes features familiar songs like It's My Party, My Boyfriend's Back, You Don't Own Me, Can't Hurry Love, and many more. All the music is really good, Hansen said. It's songs that everyone's going to know. Hansen, a Mason City High School junior, is participating in her 4th traveling show. She was last on stage with her siblings in Matilda the Musical in December. Abby and the Absolutes last appeared on the Stebbins stage during the 2014-2015 season when Civarelli's older sister, Sophia, played Connie. We always have good traveling shows, but this one is so much fun, she said. I remember watching it when my sister was in it, and I just fell in love with everything about it. It's definitely a good one. Civarelli, who was cast as Darlene, said she auditioned for the musical because the traveling shows are her favorite part of Stebbins. This will be her 4th appearance in a Stebbins touring show. I'm with all my best friends, so it's a tight cast, she said. Civarelli, a Mason City High School senior, said her character is controlling, jealous, and wants to be the lead but isn't talented enough. He's like the queen of the show, she said. Civarelli was last on the Stebbins stage as Mrs. Wormwood in Matilda the Musical. This is definitely a lot different from the roles I've played in the past, she said. Her favorite part of Abby and the Absolutes is the dancing, which was choreographed by her, Hansen, and Rogers. Rogers, a Mason City High School senior, is making her Stebbins touring show debut as Abby, an experienced and poised one-hit country artist who joins the group. Well, I figured it was my senior year and I might as well do as much as I can, and I also figured that these are the only people I hang out with anyways, so I might as well join. Rogers said she enjoys being a part of the touring show because of the cast, the singing, and the dancing. It depends on the day, she said. Rogers last appeared on the children's stage as the witch in Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. Also a part of the show are musical director Rachel Everest, stage manager Amelia Morawski, assistant stage manager and assistant director Kylie Hansen, and understudy Janae Hansen. Balmer said after this weekend, Abby and the Absolutes will be available to travel to businesses and other venues throughout the season to entertain North Iowans and provide the cast the opportunity to perform in different places. We're hoping to tour, he said. Last year we did Larry Wells and the Charming Harmonies, and we did some touring in the winter, and all our spring touring was wiped out. We're hoping this year it will be different. This weekend's public performances are the theater's first since Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs in February due to COVID-19. The pandemic shortened the theater's 2019-2020 season by 3 productions, Anything Goes, Stepping Out at Stebbins, and Buried Treasure. Buried Treasure and Anything Goes have been rescheduled for October and April, respectively, in the 2020-2021 season. Other shows planned for the season are Snoopy in December, Winnie the Pooh in February, Stepping Out at Stebbins in May, and Charlotte's Web in June. Balmer said the theater's first 3 main stage productions feature small casts. Stebbins is also limiting tickets, requiring masks, and eliminating cast-audience interactions to reduce the spread of COVID-19. About 30 tickets will be sold for each show, and seating will be socially distanced. It's going to be different, but we want people to know that we're being responsible, Balmer said. Tickets to Abby and the Absolutes are $11 for adults and $8 for children 18 and younger. They are available at the theater or by calling the box office at 641-424-9802 between 1 and 5 p.m. weekdays. Lawson Losey leads the Wildcats at Riceville. Visiting the Riceville football team's stats page on Varsity Bound poses an interesting question. Can one player really do it all? Junior middle linebacker and quarterback Lawson Losey is testing out that theory at Riceville. He leads his team in passing yards, rushing yards, interceptions, and solo tackles. He also punts and has one kick return for 29 yards. His 95 rushing attempts are the most in the state out of all classes. Head coach Steph Fair was hoping for Losey to step into a big role this year, and, so far, Losey has delivered in the statistical sense of the game. Offensively, he's our quarterback, which in eight-man, that's kind of your feature back, Fair said. He's had to run and pass, and he's really grown into more of a passing role. He still runs a lot more, but he's added that to his repertoire a bit more. Defensively, he's part of our linebacking crew. He's in quite a bit of action on both sides of the ball. Losey played tight end a year ago, but also got some reps in at quarterback. He says he's worked hard in the offseason to make sure that he could take the quarterback position over successfully in 2020. Now, while he does throw the ball, he runs it more than anybody in the state. I would say our offense is probably around me, Losey said. I've been getting a lot of rushing yards and carries, but I think that's good because defenses know that we're always going to go to me, but then we can easily throw a pass and they'll be like, what the heck? We can easily get the defense on their heels, that's for sure. Although he gets plenty of rushing attempts, there's been some growing pains passing the ball. He's thrown 3 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. He likes to be the guy in the spotlight, and he's not afraid to fail, Fair said. He'll take chances and do stuff like that. While Losey leads on offense, he also leads on defense, along with senior Charlie Ring. The pair both play linebacker and each have 23 solo tackles. Ring has Losey beat in total tackles with 30.5, but Losey isn't far behind with 29. He does a great job, too, Losey said. He has more tackles than me. I'm going to try to get in front of him this week, but we're always going back and forth. We both love that middle position, and I think we do pretty well managing it. With all of the roles Losey embraces, one might think that he would be loud and outspoken. Fair says that's not the case, as Losey is more of a lead-by-example type of player at quarterback and linebacker. I think it's a good spot for me. I try to be the leader on this team, Losey said. I mean, that's what I look at myself as, and I think those are 2 great positions for it. After winning their first game of the season against Turkey Valley, the Wildcats have dropped 2 in a row and sit at 1-2 on the season as of press time. Losey's statistical success hasn't necessarily translated to wins yet. We still have a lot of games, and I think that we can easily turn that around, Losey said. Every game we've been right in it. We've taken 2 pretty bad losses the past 2 weeks, but we were right there in the fourth quarter. Losey says the defense is playing a bit better than the offense right now. He and Fair hope the team improve in all facets of the game before the most important time of the season hits. With everybody making the playoffs this year, one loss isn't going to be a demise to your season, Fair said. We just talk every day about being ready to get better every week so we can put our best game together, which would be week 8, the first round of the playoffs. The next chance to see Losey and the Riceville football team in action is Friday night against Tripoli. A letter to the editor. September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month. September 2020 is definitely a different start to fall, but one thing that has not changed is that children are still being diagnosed with cancer. September is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month, with a gold ribbon representing childhood cancer awareness. Stomping Out Childhood Cancer, a local charity begun in 2018 to help local families who are experiencing this devastating disease, is holding an online auction on Facebook from September 21st through September 27th to raise money for local families and for research. What a wonderful world it would be if no family ever again had to hear those horrible words, "Your child has cancer." If you have not seen a child go through cancer treatment, you are lucky. These kids are warriors and my heroes. Please take a moment to recognize that this is Childhood Cancer Awareness Month and help in whatever way you can. Go gold for the kids. Signed, Donna Bowl, Clear Lake. A letter to the editor. USPS can't handle the mail-in ballot load? Mr. President and all your chatty Cathy, remember the string, operatives, please stop the rhetoric about mail delivery issues. The week of Christmas 2019, USPS successfully delivered 2.5 million pieces of first-class mail, think of a ballot, in addition to all of the packages they handled. If every registered voter voted via mail, and we all know the turnout will be much less than 100%, that volume would be less than 1/16th of that Christmas week success in 2019. The November 3 volume is hardly an issue for USPS. Signed, Bob Freund, Green. A letter to the editor. State officials shouldn't overstep their limits. My public service includes 8 years in city government, 4 years in state government, 4 years in federal government. I clearly understand and value each level of jurisdiction. It is very troubling for me to see the lines becoming dangerously blurred between these unique individual bodies. We citizens elect city council members from our hometown. They are people we know, trust, respect to manage the business of our community. We shop, dine, worship with them every week. We know their values and they know ours. It is a government that truly is closest to the people. We follow the same criteria as we elect county supervisors, state legislators, school board members. For a state governor to believe he or she knows more about a community, county, or school district is just wrong. It is increasingly difficult to recruit public servants for these positions to be trumped by a governor or decisions that should rightfully be yours is discouraging. We are seeing this boundary intrusion across the nation. I fully understand the role of state officials and their place in the hierarchy, and I believe that federal government is the least representative of the citizenry. These are dangerous times in many ways that we are traversing, but the lines of authority in government need to be reinforced. Signed, Betty Sukup, Clear Lake. Letter to the editor. Mitchell County wise to utilize part of TIF revenue for housing projects. Last Sunday, I read a letter to the editor in the GG from Al Winters. I am amazed the GG continues to print his letters, as like many previous letters from Al Winters, this letter was full of misinformation and half-truths. According to the 2015 estimate from the Census Bureau, of the 8 counties in the North Iowa Area Council of Governments territory, Mitchell County was the only county to grow in population. Growth was by 81. Mitchell County is wisely utilizing the wind farm TIFs in part on affordable housing projects. The Mitchell County Economic Development Corporation makes what I reference as a government loan up to $30,000 to any house buyer, not the builder, to purchase a 3-bedroom spec house. This house will pay property taxes to the various taxing bodies. An actual house north of St. Ansgar received the $30,000 loan. The taxable assessed value of this house is $190,117 and pays property taxes of $4,826 annually. In just 6 years and 2 months, the various taxing bodies will receive a total of $30,000 in property taxes, or in 20 years, will have paid $96,520 in property taxes. To look at this another way, the taxpayers of Mitchell County are receiving a 16% return on investment. If Mitchell County failed to offer this incentive, this house may not have been built in Mitchell County, nor would we be receiving these taxes annually. Mitchell County welcomes new home buyers into our many wonderful communities. Signed, Stan Walk, St. Ansgar. Inquiry clears Webster County deputy in shooting death. The Iowa Attorney General's office has determined a Webster County deputy was legally justified in the August 4th fatal shooting of a woman near Fort Dodge, state officials announced Thursday. After reviewing an investigation by the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation, the Attorney General's office cleared Deputy Brett Knippel in the shooting of Melissa Halda, 39, of Fort Dodge. The shooting happened the evening of August 4th when Webster County and Fort Dodge officers were called to a home and told a woman was armed with 2 knives and was suicidal. The officers found Halda, who threatened the officers with the knives and moved toward them, according to the DCI investigation. Although the officers tried to deploy a stun gun, they said Halda approached them too quickly. Knippel fired 5 times, striking Halda with 4 bullets and killing her. In reviewing the case, investigators made use of patrol car and body camera video. Big Ten football to begin in late October. Walking into the Iowa football complex Wednesday, Hawkeye receiver Brandon Smith was caught on camera wearing a mask that struggled to shield a wide smile. "Happy to be back," the Iowa senior said, echoing the sentiments of players, coaches, administrators, parents, and fans after the Big Ten reversed course and announced plans to start its previously postponed football season on the weekend of October 23rd. Big Ten teams will play an 8-game regular season that will end with a unique 9th-week twist. In addition to playing a conference championship game featuring the champions of its 2 divisions, the Big Ten will pair opponents who finished in each corresponding position in the 2 divisions all the way down to a matchup between 7th-place finishers on the final week of the season. The conference announced Wednesday morning it will move forward with a football season after the Big Ten Council of Presidents and Chancellors adopted significant medical protocols, including daily antigen testing, enhanced cardiac screening, and an enhanced data-driven approach to facilitate decisions about whether practices and games can take place. The same group of campus leaders had decided on August 11th to postpone all fall sports in the league because of concerns about the COVID-19 pandemic and the ability to protect the health and safety of student athletes. Morton Shapiro, the president of Northwestern University and chair of the Big Ten Administrative Group, said medical advancements and additional research into the coronavirus and myocarditis ultimately led the conference to its decision. "When the decision was made 5 weeks ago, we were told there was virtually no chance to have a season safely, but medical opinions have changed," Shapiro said. "When facts changed, minds changed." Big Ten presidents and chancellors studied those changes last weekend. Hearing Saturday from the Big Ten's Return to Competition Task Force Medical Committee and gaining additional information Sunday before ultimately reaching the decision to move forward. Iowa Director of Athletics Gary Barta said, "The frequency, availability, and reliability of daily testing was a game changer." Barta credited the work of medical professionals on every Big Ten campus for tireless work in creating strong protocols that can be consistently applied on every campus. "Daily testing for student athletes, coaches, and staff members will begin on Big Ten campuses as soon as possible and will be in place by September 30th. Teams will take the field for their first games 3.5 weeks later. Iowa coach Kirk Ferentz called that welcome news for all of our players, coaches, and fans. Like their peers throughout the conference, the Hawkeyes have continued to train since fall semester classes began and will move into more of a preseason camp mode in the upcoming days. "We are raring to go, but we're hardly ready to go, and that's a big concern I have right now," Ferentz said in an interview with the Big Ten Network. "But just to get some clarity and be able to tell our guys that there is a specific start to the season is great." Ferentz said his players have maintained a good attitude and work ethic throughout several weeks of uncertainty. "The players are very excited to play, and the coaches are excited to coach them," Ferentz said. The Big Ten decision comes days after teams in 2 other Power 5 conferences, the Atlantic Coast and Big 12, started their seasons. A third, the Southeastern Conference, will kick off its season next week. Big Ten Commissioner Kevin Warren said the plan, as approved, is the product of a collaborative effort between administrators and medical personnel throughout the conference and meets the objective of ensuring the health and safety of participants as they return to competition. "Our goal has always been to return to competition so all student athletes can realize their dream of competing in the sports they love," Warren said. Wednesday's decision applies only to football. Warren said administrators will begin discussions Thursday about the possibility of other fall sports that were postponed resuming competition this fall using the same medical protocols as football. "Some sports," he said, "may continue to move forward with plans to compete in the spring as the NCAA has moved national championships in several to the spring semester." And that does it for today's reading of the Mason City Globe Gazette for Thursday, September 17th, 2020. I'm your reader, Leanne Bakerose. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. Thanks for listening.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. A decade ago, there were typically 20 earthquakes a year that were large enough to feel in the central and eastern U.S. But in 2015, there were over 1,000 of them. Why? It's mostly because we're pumping more water into the ground. The boom in U.S. oil and gas production over the last decade has brought many more oil wells, which also produce water. Most is naturally occurring in the formation, and some was injected by operators to allow or improve the recovery of oil and gas. In both cases, the water will likely have picked up salt and other minerals from the rock, making it many times saltier than seawater. Operators may re-inject this water to continue to liberate oil and gas. But more often, there's too much to handle, so it's trucked or piped to disposal wells, where it's pumped down into deep saltwater reservoirs. Adding large volumes of wastewater increases the pressure in these rock formations, which can allow natural faults to slip more easily than they normally would, causing earthquakes. To address these quakes, regulators and the petroleum industry are monitoring disposal wells and shutting down those that could cause damaging seismic activity. And they now think that managing wastewater injection more carefully should help. There's still more work to be done, and university research centers, like the Bureau of Economic Geology, are conducting major studies, with the aim of minimizing the risk of earthquakes while maintaining the benefits of domestic energy production. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.